Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Future of the Responsible Company, What We've Learned from Patagonia's First 50 Years, by Vincent Stanley, with Yvonne Chouinard, narrated by Grant Cartwright. Publisher's note: this audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit tantor.com and type The Future of the Responsible Company into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then, under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code SUSTAINABLE, and then click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters, photos, figures, and appendix. The checklists can be found in the bonus material. The most important right we have is the right to be responsible. Gerald Amos. Preface. In the decade since we wrote The Responsible Company, What We've Learned from Patagonia's First 40 Years, dramatic shifts have taken place in the world and at Patagonia. This new edition, which marks our 50th year in business, reflects these changes. The aim of the book, however, remains the same: to articulate the elements of business responsibility for our time, when everyone working at every level has to face the unintended consequences of a 250-year-old industrial model that can no longer be sustained ecologically, socially, or financially. Yvonne has said that Patagonia, or any company for that matter, should behave as though it will be around in 100 years. You don't pump up and hollow out a company meant to stay in business for a good long time. This once standard American business ethos was eclipsed in the 1960s by Milton Friedman's doctrine of shareholder primacy, wherein the sole purpose of a business is to maximize profits. That objective helps keep a stock's price high, but doesn't work in the long run for society, the planet, or even the health of a business. In the 1950s, the average corporation survived to celebrate its 61st birthday. Now it barely makes it to 20. Business founders don't live forever, and a 50-year-old company that wants to live responsibly for another 50 years needs a succession plan that involves far more than a change of the person sitting at the head of the table. In 2012, Patagonia became a California benefit corporation, which allowed us to enshrine into our business charter our core values and practices, including an annual gift of 1% of sales to grassroots environmental organizations. The company's long-time purpose statement, build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, and use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis, could now legally outlast our original ownership. To dissuade anyone of different values from buying in, we required a vote of 100% of the company shares to alter the charter. Dismayed by the deepening crisis and the ineffective response from businesses and governments, Yvonne rewrote our statement in 2018 to reflect a sharper focus. We're in business to save our home planet. It had been nearly 30 years since Patagonia first committed to inspire and implement solutions, 30 years of effort to cause no unnecessary harm. We were proud of our work and the products that resulted, but whatever we did each day to push the rock uphill, it came tumbling back down. Global economic activity trespassed ever more of the planet's physical boundaries. Greenhouse gases climbed, storms intensified, rivers dried at the mouth, soil turned to dust, and species continued to disappear at 1,000 times their natural rate. Our sharpened purpose, though, meant more than a race against the doomsday clock. We'd learned something new and promising over the last decade from Patagonia Provisions, our venture into the food business. Regenerative organic practices to cultivate food and fiber could restore topsoil, slow the depletion of groundwater and pollution of rivers, draw carbon from the atmosphere deep into the soil, restore habitat, improve biodiversity, and along the way, help revive the health of rural communities. In 2016, we introduced organic long-root ale made with kernza, a perennial wheatgrass with roots that descend 10 feet or deeper, where they create the proper conditions for microbes and fungi to generate topsoil. 2 years later, we began working with smallholder farmers in India to grow organic cotton with regenerative practices, including companion planting of turmeric to discourage harmful insects and generate a second source of income. Patagonia Provisions pointed our apparel business toward a new North Star. We could do better than doing less harm or becoming carbon neutral. We could give back to Earth as much as or more than we take. We could do positive good. In 2022, the Chouinard family committed the entire value of the company, monetary and moral, to our new purpose. The family donated 100% of the company's stock to two entities, an irrevocable Patagonia Purpose Trust and a 501c4 charitable organization, the Holdfast Collective, that commits Patagonia's annual profits to groups working to save our home planet. Earth is now our sole shareholder. I remember being ushered a few years back into the office of a dean of a small liberal arts college after giving a talk there. The dean, a pale man in his 60s, wearing a grey suit and tie, was responsible for helping graduates find their first real jobs. He had a serious problem, he said, lowering his voice to an anguished whisper. None of them will go to work for bad companies. That's a good problem to have. If the elements of business responsibility have not changed much in the past decade, their cultural context certainly has. Young people now want to work for responsible companies. Business students know there is no longer a convincing financial case to be made for being a bad company. Drawing on our experience at Patagonia, the only company we know in any depth, we hope to write usefully for all people who see the need for deep change in business practices and who may work in companies quite unlike ours. Although we mainly address companies that make things, or, like us, design things made by others, this book is germane to all businesses, as well as civic organizations and non-profits that want to treat their people well and improve the environmental performance of their operations. Although of particular interest to business leaders and managers, this book is for anyone who wants to engage their best, deepest self in the working life that stretches ahead. Vincent Stanley with Yvonne Chouinard. 1. What crisis? Wilderness is, in the words of naturalist Margaret Murray, where the hand of man does not linger. It is as much a spiritual concept as a definition of place. Humans are part of nature, and if we had no experience of it in its wild state, we would lose entirely our sense of human scale. We need to engage with the magnificence and mystery of the unknown to know ourselves and our place in the world. Emerson, Thoreau, and other transcendentalists learned and taught these lessons in New England in the 1830s through the 1860s. We can learn, they said, directly from nature about who we are and how to live. Theodore Roosevelt agreed, after a transformative camping trip to Yosemite in 1903, where he skipped the comfort of a cabin to sleep in a bedroll under the stars, the president became committed to preserving American wilderness. Before leaving office, he would designate 230 million acres as protected public land. It might surprise some to know that in 1972, Roosevelt's political descendant, Richard Nixon, who a year later would sign the Endangered Species Act, wrote, "This is the environmental awakening. It marks a new sensitivity of the American spirit and a new maturity of American public life. It is working a revolution in values, as commitment to responsible partnership with nature replaces cavalier assumptions that we can play God with our surroundings and survive. It is leading to broad reforms in action, as individuals, corporations, government, and civic groups mobilize to conserve resources, to control pollution, to anticipate and prevent emerging environmental problems, to manage the land more wisely, and to preserve wilderness." 50 years after Nixon wrote that, Americans are the most avid practitioners of the high-growth, material-intensive capitalism that is to blame for nature's destruction. If the United States is the birthplace of conservation, of the very idea of wilderness as its own value, and of nature as a teacher, its citizens have behaved more as conquerors than stewards of the wild. We harm nature by what we add to it. One example from our watch, perfluorinated compounds, PFCs, that the outdoor industry, including Patagonia, before phasing them out, has used as effective, durable repellents against water and dirt. Known as forever chemicals, PFCs are toxic and don't break down and dissolve when they enter waterways, the stomachs of birds, or the human bloodstream. For the past 200 years, industry has created a colossal number of chemicals in massive amounts that living things previously didn't have to absorb. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, identified 62,000 industrial chemicals in 1982 without screening or proscribing their use. Another 24,000 or so have been added since then. Only a few hundred have been tested. Only 9 have been banned. You carry in your body, in addition to PFCs, traces of 200 chemicals unknown to your ancestors, some of them toxic in large amounts, others slow-acting carcinogens in small amounts. A chemical present in your blood may have no effect on its own, but prove dangerous in combination with another. Untested interactions among the various chemicals released into nature can form up to 3 billion combinations. Because we know so little, it is difficult to trace our diseases back to their environmental source. Certain diseases have become prevalent in affluent countries at much higher rates than in the less developed world, which may reflect reduced physical resilience. These include inflammatory autoimmune disorders like asthma, allergies, lupus, and multiple sclerosis. Non-smokers who reach middle age can now expect to have levels of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, a precursor to emphysema, equal to that of smokers. Breast cancer rates for women have tripled during the past 40 years, and only 5 to 10% of breast cancers are considered hereditary. Scientists are slow to link specific cancers to specific environmental causes, such as high-voltage wires, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, in the river, or your cell phone. Few cancer catalysts have been studied as closely or confirmed as definitively as cigarette smoke, but some environmentally caused illnesses can be clearly traced. We know that mercury poisoning results from eating too many large predatory fish, such as tuna and swordfish. Through runoff from sewage and fertilizer, we have added significantly to the nitrogen and phosphorus in the water supply. These extra nutrients create algae blooms that choke off oxygen and kill fish. Half the lakes in Asia, Europe, and North America suffer from such eutrophication, as does much of the Gulf of Mexico. We harm nature by altering it. The atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide has now reached its highest level in 4 million years and continues to grow, making hot air hotter, cold air colder, and increasing the ferocity of storms. Arctic winter ice decreased 9% each decade for 3 decades. In the past decade, it decreased 13%, and every winter, more of Western Antarctica's ice shelves carve into the ocean. We have borrowed from nature what we can't pay back. In 1960, humanity consumed about half of the planet's potential resource capacity. By 1987, we exceeded it. 25 years later, we were using the resource capacity of 1.5 planets. Now, we are using the resource capacity of 1.75 planets. The pattern of consumption is lopsided. Europe, proportionate to its population, consumes the equivalent resources of 3 planets. For North America, the number is 7. Meanwhile, China and India, the world's most populous countries, now have sizable, growing, and resource-consuming middle classes. Alfred North Whitehead described the perpetual novelty we experience from nature's creative advance. But nature generates its changes at a much slower pace than we now allow, and in more complex ways than we can easily recognize. As a result, we're now in the midst of the planet's 6th extinction crisis. The 5th was that of the dinosaurs. In a 2009 article in Nature, Johan Rockström identified 9 Earth system processes and associated thresholds which, if crossed, could generate unacceptable environmental change. Biodiversity is the planetary boundary humans have violated most. The threshold for an extinction crisis is a loss of 10 species per million per year. We are losing species now at the rate of 100 per million per year, or 1,000 times, not a typo, the normal rate. Among the most imminently vulnerable are 30% of amphibians and 21% of mammals, including the polar bear, rhinoceros, tiger, giraffe, and gorilla. Meanwhile, 12% of bird species are threatened with extinction, as are 73% of flowering plants, 27% of corals, and 50% of fungi and protists. None of this matters if you can persuade one of the Silicon Valley billionaires to let you accompany them to a new life on Mars. We understand that among those who remain on Earth, not everyone suffers from the loss of the polar bear on its melting ice floe or the rhino gone from its muddy African river. But biodiversity, critical in its own right, is also key to human survival, biological and economic. More than half of the global gross domestic product, GDP, the standard, if deeply flawed, measure of the world's aggregated economic output, depends on the capacity of nature to deliver ecosystem services. If the rain doesn't fall, grass doesn't grow. As bees fail to thrive, so do the plants they no longer pollinate. Fish cannot live in water deprived of oxygen by chemical runoff from farmland. And fish cannot live where there is no water at all. Withdrawals from lakes and rivers have doubled since 1960, as more of the Earth's major rivers, on which huge populations depend, fail to reach the sea. The ocean's coastal, eutrophic, or dead zones expand. The dammed Colorado River now rarely flows into the Gulf of California, and its former delta is a toxic swamp. Very shortly, no major Chinese river will meet the ocean all year long, which will devastate wetlands and the birds and fish that rely on them. Worldwide, wetlands diminish and disappear every year, as do coral reefs and mangroves. Major fisheries are collapsing. Loss of rainforest continues in poorer countries and in not-so-poor Brazil. Conventional ploughing and planting without crop rotation has led to significant loss of topsoil, at the rate of 1 inch per year in the American Midwest. It takes 500 years for 2 millimeters of topsoil to form naturally. The consequences of human overreach are magnified in poor and/or overpopulated countries. Shrinking resources only aggravate the long-standing challenges of inadequate food, water, and sanitation. In short, the world is turning into desert. Globalization, a human-made but not humanly controlled process, is largely responsible for the current speed at which life turns to sand. Globalization moves with great speed to identify, then harvest resources for human needs, but crawls slowly to repair the devastation left in its wake. It is fast, but stupid, brutal, and imprecise. To cull a tree, it takes out a forest. The richer the country, the greater the waste. Those who watch the forest being cut and raise their voices against it cannot be heard when the company that cuts the trees does not belong to the community. When local politics become subservient to distant economic power, the concept of citizenship, of its duties and possibilities, loses its meaning. The human commons loses its value. It too becomes desert. Democracy is often a condition of ecological health. In 2022, the Environmental Performance Index, EPI, ranked the world's 10 top countries as Denmark, the United Kingdom, Finland, Malta, Sweden, Luxembourg, Slovenia, Austria, Switzerland, and Iceland. Most of these countries have small populations, but other European nations, including the Netherlands, Germany, France, and Norway, regularly make the top 20. No autocracies do. Citizens with no power to act will not be able to save the planet or defend its ability to heal itself. Yet over the past decade, the world, capitalist or communist, democratic or autocratic, has in critical ways agreed to what needs to be done to halt the desert's spread and restore ecological health. In 2015, more than 180 nations signed on to the Paris Accords, which led to the Science Based Targets Initiative to achieve a net zero world by 2050. A later US withdrawal was mercifully temporary. Also in 2015, the world's nations agreed to the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, which created a crucial common language and specific courses of action for businesses, governments, and civil society to achieve by 2050. The SDGs implicitly acknowledged what Pope Francis described in his encyclical Laudato Si on care for our common home as one crisis with two faces, social and environmental. They call on countries, rich and poor, to develop economies in support of ecological and social health. Multinational businesses could retire their endless committee discussions about what a company should do to be a good global citizen and instead get to work. That work is now behind schedule on all fronts. Greenwashing is rampant, and there is a lot of what Greta Thunberg calls blah, blah, blah. But the agreement in its tattered state stands. Powering industry and homes through renewable energy is no longer an economic challenge. Prices have fallen by 90% over the decade. There is no denying the big carbon culprits, cars and other forms of transportation, cows, cement, fertilizer. Business people and politicians have committed to greening the economy for practical as well as cynical reasons. Greening means, in certain sectors, simply slowing the economy. During the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, few could ignore that the decline of economic activity quickly reduced levels of pollution, including emissions of greenhouse gases. The world of plants and animals quickened its pulse and showed signs of thriving. We saw that nature wants to come back, that changing our behavior really does matter. In 2021, the Biden administration embraced a worldwide initiative called 30 by 30, which calls for the conservation of 30% of the globe's marine and terrestrial habitat by 2030. The biologist E.O. Wilson went further, though on a longer timescale, calling for a half-Earth approach to preserve 50% of the Earth's land and oceans by 2050. We strongly support that. As of 2022, only 17% of the Earth's land and 8% of its oceans are protected. We all depend on the whole web of life, biodiversity. It would be cold irony indeed if humanity were to find a way to live with fewer cars and cows, electrify the economy, and finesse climate change but still suffer extinction because we paid so little attention to the conditions of health for forms of life other than our own. 2. Meaningful work. Everyone wants to have meaningful work, but what exactly makes work meaningful? And what does meaningful work have to do with the responsible company? At its heart, to have meaningful work is to do something for a living that you love and are good at doing. Most people don't know, at first, what they love best. What they become best at develops by trial and error or by accident. We're all good at something, with words or numbers, or working with our hands, or working outside. One of the authors of this book, Yvonne, would rather spend his day picking apricots or working in his garden than sit at a desk and stare into a computer screen. Repetitive, rhythmic work need not be numbing, as anyone who has spent all day hammering pitons at the forge knows. It can be enlightening, or joyous, as in the scene in Anna Karenina, where the aristocrat, Levin, scythes wheat with his peasants. He can't keep up with them until he learns how to fall into the rhythm. Vincent, on the other hand, once spent a muddy October picking grapes for a living and has to be prodded to work outside in the garden. He doesn't mind the screen, although he prefers pen and paper. No responsible company can function well without a lot of different people doing things they love to do in concert with one another. At Patagonia, we have found that doing what you love, but also doing the right thing, with others, is what makes work meaningful. Although this book is not a history of Patagonia, this chapter draws on our experience to explain how one company's responsible actions, some small, some large, help make work meaningful for its employees, and how responsible behavior, as it becomes cumulative, makes a company smarter, nimbler, and potentially more successful. In their early days, Chouinard Equipment for Alpinists and Patagonia attracted the disaffected, people who loved climbing and surfing or vagabonding best, and would come back to Ventura to pick up work for a few months at a time. Or people who had a degree in physics or biology, but for one reason or another, usually the inability or unwillingness to fit into an academic culture, changed course. They would find a home at Patagonia, in a culture congenially filled with other outsiders, the way Paris and Manhattan were for 20th century artists. A high school guidance counselor told Christine Tompkins's mother not to waste her money sending her daughter to college. Chris, an unmotivated and indifferent student, would by age 30 become Patagonia's CEO during its critical early days. In midlife, with her husband Doug Tompkins, Chris would help save or restore more than 2 million acres of exhausted ranch land and surrounding wilderness in Chile and Argentina. We did not bristle with overachievers who could find reward in what we all saw as the real world. Instead, we attracted bright, restless, unconventional people like Chris, who hadn't felt the call toward a vocation, and others who had sought and then abandoned one, or had pursued one that couldn't provide a living. Many Patagonia employees turned out to have a vocation working for a small, quirky company where no one knew what they couldn't do, so they ended up doing things, with the help of co-workers they had no idea they could do. Something as ostensibly silly as working in the clothing business turned out to engage the intelligence, imagination, and social needs of our unconventional anti-establishment colleagues. Today, Patagonia employs a lot of people who found their vocation early and answered it. They were drawn to colour from infancy, or started sewing clothes of their own design when they were 10 or earned a graduate degree in textile chemistry. We have MBAs who really love business for itself, and others who earned the degree to help them do well in life. We're not awash in entrepreneurs who would rather be working for themselves. Patagonia also has bright locals who grew up in the Ventura area, feel at home here, don't want to leave, and find our company the most interesting place in town to work. It's the best place in town for women to work. Conversely, we have a few top executives who don't want to live in Ventura because their families are settled elsewhere. They can afford to commute, and do. As was true for other companies, our campus felt abandoned during the COVID pandemic. Every desk left as it was the night before we shut down for 2 years. Many employees left town to be closer to the mountains or to grandparents who could help those working from home with children. Many people seek work at Patagonia because the company's values reflect their own. That deep sympathy provides the extra motivation it takes to stay level-headed and alert when a workday gets difficult. It keeps people engaged when they have to work hard to find a new fabric source because the old one contains a toxic dye, or negotiate with a factory to invest a jaw-dropping sum in better ventilation, or persuade a realtor that raw farmland is not where Patagonia should place a new distribution center. Doing the right thing motivates us to work past the point where we might otherwise give up. Meaningful work, it turns out, is not only doing what we love, but also giving back to the world. The combination creates the ground for a kind of excellence ordinary humans can and want to achieve. If it wants to become more responsive and responsible, a company needs to cultivate this ordinary human excellence. Every time people in the company do something new that was formerly thought impossible, they contribute significantly to the company's culture and to the sense that much will be possible in the future. We can think of several critical moments in Patagonia's past that changed our sense of the possible, when we became a more responsible and thus more motivated company without necessarily knowing we were doing so. We were just trying to sell some clothes for a living. What follows are some of the moments and people who increased our sense of responsibility and our capacity to act responsibly. we'd like to explain how these moments built on one another. The intention here is less to celebrate our own experience than to tell some stories you might find reassuring and instructive and helpful in the course of your own work. We'd like to discuss how any group of people going about their business can come to realize their environmental and social responsibilities.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?